I'd like to invite you to turn your Bibles to Acts chapters 15 and 16. That'll be the text of our study this morning. We can greatly appreciate the sentiments of the song that we've just been singing, I'm sure, and perhaps at times in life sing it very confidently. The mighty God, omniscient one, his ways we cannot trace. He reckons every good begun, crowns it with his grace. Lo, I can see him in his word. I will not doubt or fear. My steps are ordered to the Lord. His guiding hand is near. No trial can my spirit break, for God will not forsake. He will with each temptation make a way for my escape. The future beckons and I bow. My God removes the care. Behold, he goes before me now and will my way prepare. He's here, he's there, he's everywhere. In all the ways I've trod, I've never passed beyond the sphere of the providence of God. There are times in life, though, aren't there, when we might begin to wonder, which way are we going next? What does life hold for me around the next bend? How is this going to work out for my good? It's very difficult for me to see anything positive or helpful in the situation that I'm in. And I hope that we could all sing the sentiments of that song with great confidence and great strength. But it might be that there are some here this morning that might have hedged a little bit on that. I wonder where God's hand is in the circumstances that have befallen me. And if Paul had had that song to sing when he was traveling at the beginning of the second missionary journey, I wonder if he might not have been humming that tune along the way. And that's what I want to look at with you. At the end of Acts 15 and then into Acts 16, we have the beginning of Paul's second preaching tour, missionary journey, if you will. And what I would like to do at the beginning part of the lesson is just to go through and do a historical narrative with you. Look at the places Paul went and take a look at what was happening to him from place to place, and hopefully the dots will become a little clearer as we go along. First of all, in Acts 15, verses 36 through 39, then after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they're doing. Noble undertaking. Apparently, an objective suggested with all positiveness and with hope of success in every way. But then verse 37, there's something of a monkey wrench thrown into this. Now Barnabas was determined to take with them John, called Mark, but Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. This is in reference to the first preaching tour, where Mark, a younger relative of Barnabas, had begun accompanying them and had traveled with him through the island of Cyprus, and then, for reasons not defined in the Scriptures, leaves this traveling party and goes back home. Second time around, apparently Barnabas wants to give Mark a second chance. And it seems that Paul's feeling is not so much he didn't want to give him a second chance, but the notion that the work is too important to entrust to someone who has failed it once already. But Barnabas was determined in verse 37, and Paul insisted in verse 38. They were both equally determined and held to their position. Verse 39, the contention became so sharp that they parted from one another, and so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, and Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God. There isn't anything said overtly in the Scriptures as to how Paul emotionally felt about this, but he is a human being. And Barnabas is not just a co-worker, but someone who in times past was the mediator between Paul and the church in Jerusalem. When they were afraid to accept Paul in as a faithful Christian, thinking that he might be gathering intelligence for further persecution against them, Barnabas interceded and persuaded the brethren in Jerusalem to accept Paul. Then when Barnabas was sent to Antioch to see about this new work among the Gentiles, Paul had gone back to his home in Tarsus, awaiting further instructions from the Lord as to how to execute this apostolic commission granted to him. It was Barnabas that came to Tarsus and got Paul and brought him to Antioch, and together they were working in that city before the first journey began. So there's a history with these two men, a history of mutual respect and mutual work, but undoubtedly what we would call deep friendship based on what Barnabas had done for Paul. And so we begin, I think, this particular journey on a downer, that these two great servants of the Lord feel compelled to go their separate ways and feel as if, based on present circumstances, they simply cannot continue because they have a difference as to how they view going forward in the work. But then we have something of a little upswing in verses 40 and 41 of Acts 15. But Paul chose Silas and departed. And if you read back in Acts, which we won't, but Silas has come on the scene earlier for a different reason. But now part of Paul and Barnabas splitting, Paul sees that Silas perhaps is one that can be devoted to the work in a proper way. And so I think that what begins to happen here is we have an upward swing, a return of optimism perhaps to the work that Paul is being called to do. So he's joined by Silas. And then in verse 41, he went through Syria, that's Paul, but with Silas, went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. That's the area that's right around Antioch, and then up around the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea, and then back to the region where Paul was originally from. They set out from Antioch, Paul and Silas together, and they began doing the work of the Lord, which in and of itself is usually the restoration of optimism for us, a return of excitement about things, that we're now busy in the work of the Lord. Whoops, let's go back one. Then in chapter 16, verses 1 through 3, Paul and Silas now come to the area where they had spent some time, or where Paul had spent some time earlier with Barnabas. And here they're joined by a young man who becomes very prominent in the Scriptures from this point on, and intertwined with the history and the life of Paul. He came to Derbe and Lystra in verse 1 of chapter 16. And behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was a Greek. He was well spoken of by the brethren who were at Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted to have him go on with him and took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region, for they all knew that his father was Greek. And so again, I think there's a boost, an encouragement in this unfolding of this chapter in the life of Paul. It would be a reasonable conclusion based on other things said in the New Testament that Paul had converted the mother and grandmother of Timothy, Lois and Eunice, and that Timothy then had adopted and acted upon their teaching and their faith, as Paul mentions in his epistles to Timothy later. And Timothy himself becomes a believer. And perhaps that even by Paul's influence, since Paul refers to him as a son in the faith in other places. But we find that things are on an upswing. That the journey that Paul's engaged on is encouraged again now by Timothy joining he and Silas. And then we find that the churches in Phrygia and in Galatia continue to grow because of their influence. Verses 4 and 5 of chapter 16, as they went through the cities, they delivered to them the decrees to keep, which were determined by the apostles and elders at Jerusalem. That is a reference back to what happens earlier in chapter 15. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and increased in number daily. So what had begun on a low note with the division from Barnabas has now sort of swept to a higher plane as churches are being taught and encouraged, and because of these decrees that had to do with differences between Jewish and Gentile converts to Christ, because certain matters had been settled at Jerusalem and these were now being taught to the brethren, unity and growth, maturity was taking place. And the disciples were being not only strengthened in the faith in verse 5, but they were increasing in number. And so there's outward evidence of the providence of God, if you will, the plan and purpose of God coming together through Paul and through the work done with Silas and Timothy. However, a little bit further down here, verses 6 through 8, things take something of a downturn in what's happening here with this great success and the fruitfulness of the work. It appears that a period of time goes by where even though Paul is an apostle and he's generally in his life operating under the direction of the Lord, there's a period of time in which the Lord's not real clear as to where Paul should go next. So in verses 6 through 8 of Acts 16, "Now when they had gone through Phrygia and the region of Galatia, they were forbidden by the Holy Spirit to preach the word in Asia. After they had come to Mysia, they tried to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit did not permit them. So passing by Mysia, they came down to Troas." Even for someone who is in the closest contact with the Lord in his life, an apostle, there were times of uncertainty. Well, should we go this way? Well, no. Well, maybe, seems like to me, we should go that way. Well, no. And at this point, the Lord is directing by no's rather than yes's. And isn't that frustrating for us sometimes? We're not quite sure which direction to go. We're not quite sure to make this decision or that. We're not sure where the next stage of life takes us. And it seems like that what we hear is no, no. And we want to hear a yes. This way, that way, tell me what to do, tell me where to go. And these are not just the thoughts of a moment, perhaps, in the life of Paul. To say that they tried to go to Asia, then they tried to go to Bithynia, and then ended up going to Troas, you're talking probably about weeks of travel in harsh conditions with the development of the spiritual kingdom riding on his shoulders. It certainly would have been easy for Paul to say, well, okay, Lord, if no, no, where's the yes? Where do you want me to go? And so at that point, we have, again, a little upturn in things. In verses 9 and following of chapter 16 of Acts, a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia stood and pleaded with him, saying, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." Now, after he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go to Macedonia, concluding that the Lord had called us to preach the gospel to them. So finally now, after this sort of aimless wandering, if you will, we have a direction to go in. We have an objective. We have the will of the Lord that has now been expressed in clear terms. And if that's ever been, too, a part of your life, not that we've had a vision in such a direct communication from God, but the fog clears in life and we begin to feel like, okay, it seems like this is the best direction to go in. That's usually a relief to us. As human beings, just generally speaking, and most of us would probably say this, we'd rather know which direction we're going in, or we would rather know the circumstance that we're in than not know. Even if knowing is bad, we would generally say it's better than not knowing. It's better than the doubt. It's better than the uncertainty. We just, as emotional and spiritual beings, don't generally function well in doubt and uncertainty. And in those times, what a great relief it is to serve a God who does see the end from the beginning and does understand the overall plan of things and knows what He's trying to work out, whether we can discern it in the moment or we just simply have to hang on in that moment by faith and trust that God's going to make it work out at the end of the day. What a great relief it is to not be beyond the providence of God. To never justifiably feel like God has abandoned me. God's not directing me. Sometimes God may be waiting on something else to come to pass before He's ready to say to us, okay, now, go forward. And so Paul and his party then are able to go forward. But then there's immediately almost another, perhaps a downer. In chapter 16, verses 12 and 13, they sail from Troas, they come to Samothrace, then to Neapolis, which is a coastal city in Europe, actually, leaving Asia behind. And verse 12, and from there to Philippi, which is the foremost city of that part of Macedonia, a colony, and we were staying in that city for some days. Okay, we've seen the vision of a Macedonian. How do you know he's a Macedonian? Well, if you saw someone in Japanese or Chinese regalia, you would probably be able to identify. Well, that's a clothing that is peculiar to them, or maybe it was something linguistic. But whatever, when they saw the vision of the Macedonian Troas, they knew it was a Macedonian, they then land in Macedonia, and they come to the city of Philippi, and nothing happens. There's apparently no direction for them to go in immediately, so it says, for some days they were staying there without anything significant taking place. But then we have verses 13 and following. And on the Sabbath day, we went out of the city to the riverside, where prayer was customarily made, and we sat down and spoke to the women who met there. Now a certain woman named Lydia heard us. She was a seller of purple from the city of Thyatira, who worshipped God. The Lord opened her heart to heed the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household were baptized, when she and her household were baptized, she begged us, saying, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay. And she constrained us. Again, sometimes in life we go through this to-ing and fro-ing. Well, we think we should go this way, and that ended up being a no. We think we should go that way, and well, that ended up being a no. And then a path seems more clear to us, and we follow that path, and even that doesn't perhaps turn out the way that we thought it would. Things didn't happen as quickly as we thought they might. But then, usually in life, at some point, there's this eureka moment. Oh, now I see. And if it's not one particular event, perhaps like this, it just might be the gradual dawning that, you know, the Lord did take care of me. The Lord was looking out for me. Things, now that I look back, things are turning out well for me when it seemed rather dark at one point or at many points along the way. I wonder if this is not one of those times for Paul, this eureka moment when Lydia is baptized and he's able to go, oh, I see it now coming together. I see the things that God wants me to be doing as an apostle, whereas there were weeks or perhaps months of uncertainty in Paul's life, and there were ups and there were downs. But then when she's baptized, you know, wonderful things often run through our heads when we observe someone becoming a Christian. What do you think went through Paul's mind on this occasion when Lydia was baptized? Not just for Lydia's sake, although I'm sure there was great rejoicing on that account alone, but for the sense of his own purpose in the world, where he should be, what he should be doing, that this is the outcome of the Macedonian vision. This is why God said not no forever to Asia. He only said later, because Paul's going to end up back there. But God said no for now. And Bithynia, no for now. I want you to go to Macedonia. And Paul at this point could say, oh, now I see why. He said no, and he said no, and then he said yes, as it were. Well, from the height of Lydia's conversion, there's another sort of plunge down the other side. There's another monkey wrench thrown into the whole thing. In verses 16 through 18 of Acts 16. Now it happened as we went to prayer that a certain slave girl possessed with a spirit of divination met us, who brought her masters much profit by fortune telling. This girl followed Paul and us and cried out, saying, these men are the servants of the Most High God, who proclaim to us the way of salvation. And this she did for many days. But Paul, greatly annoyed, turned and said to the Spirit, I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And he came out that very hour. Now, it's not hard to see as Luke records it here. And by the way, this is one of those passages in Luke where you've got pronouns that come into play. Verse 8, they came down, Troas, as he's been describing it. And then in verse 10, it becomes a we. They, we. What would you gather from that? Luke became part of the party in Troas. And so now it's we, us. And he's able to tell very specific things that are happening because now he becomes an eyewitness of these things. But here's this girl who's demon-possessed and being used in that state for gain by these unscrupulous men. They had no concern for her condition. They just saw a way to make money out of her. And after being irritated by this woman for, it says, many days, Paul's perhaps patience being kept in check, but perhaps beginning to fear about the influence of the gospel. But for whatever reason, and not the least of which is to give this poor girl relief, he cast the demon out of her. And for that good turn, one might think that Paul would get a pat on the back or something good would come out of this, but actually we find quite the opposite. In verses 19 through 21, when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to the authorities, and they brought them to the magistrates and said, "These men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city. And they teach customs which are not lawful for us, being Romans, to receive or observe." What is interesting from a historical point of view about this is that we find a little bit later on in Acts, but it's already taken place, Jews have been expelled from the city of Rome. And now do you see the slur in referring to them? "These men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city." We've already read in this chapter that Philippi is a what? It's a colony. That means it's a mini Rome. It reflects Roman values and Roman principles and Roman rule to a greater degree than a city that's not a colony. Philippi would have been considered an outpost, a protection, a fort, fortified city against potential invasion by the hordes. So as this outpost and as a colony so designated by Rome, you've got a very close connection between Philippi and Rome, and Rome has expelled Jews for creating trouble. So it's real easy for these men to pull Paul and Silas in and say, "You see what these Jews are now doing here? Something needs to be done." And then from arrest and accusation, it gets worse. "Then the multitude rose up," verse 22, "and the magistrates tore off their clothes and commanded them to be beaten with rods. And when they had many stripes laid on them, they threw them into the prison, commanding the jailer to keep them securely. Having received such a charge, he put them in the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks." And I'm not going to go into detail about that, but it's interesting reading if you go back and do some historical background on what this would have meant. It's sort of like James was embellishing for us in a positive way the story of Jesus hanging on the cross. We can read right past that and not feel the pain and understand the suffering. You can read right past this and, "Oh yeah, well, they beat him and they put him in prison." And then go on to the next verse. This was humiliating. It was painful. For what? For helping give relief to this poor girl who was possessed and then abused by the men getting gain from her. What are they doing? They're advancing a spiritual kingdom that gives men freedom from superstition and sin and an aimless way of life. They're restoring to people the kind of purpose and meaning in their lives that God was wanting to come to people through the gospel. And what do they get for it? Beating, their clothes ripped off, stuck in stocks in the inner part of the prison, which was, by my reading, a horrible place to be. It was where, apparently, you were awaiting execution and being put to death in the inner part of the prison. Horrible, terrible treatment for doing what God would have them to do. But then we find things begin to head upward. first of all, a result of their own attitude toward these things. In verse 25, "But at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them." Again, I don't know everything that was in Paul's mind. We do get a lot of insight into what he thinks and what he feels in books like 2 Corinthians. But you've got to be wondering if he's not humming again the providence of God. Well, how does this fit into everything? Okay, it was difficult to see which way to go, but God made that clear, and through the vision, and then Lydia being baptized, everything was going swimmingly well. And now this. What a horrible turn of events for the sake of the gospel, not to mention for us personally. Beaten and fastened in the stocks in the inner prison. Whatever they were thinking and feeling, and Paul does say in 2 Corinthians, at times we thought we weren't going to live. We weren't going to survive. What are they doing? Singing. Singing and praying, and not silently. They were being heard. I tell you, the providence of God is a great place to be. Even when things aren't going, or especially when things aren't going the way we think they ought to go, or we anticipated they would go. You know, sometimes in life, it's in the darkest and most difficult hours that we just turn loose and say, you know what? There's not anything I know to do about this. But somebody that can do more about it than I can, I'm relinquishing this situation to them. And I'm just going to praise Him and honor Him and try to be faithful to Him. And I'm going to let Him deal with the outcome of this. And so there they are, singing and praying to God. And the kind of people that have been in this prison are not white-collar criminals. But these people were apparently being very impressed in a positive way by what they're hearing from Paul and Silas. And then, in verse 26, we have what I think fairly can be considered divine intervention. "Suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's chains were loosed." Sometimes in studying the Bible, we draw certain conclusions that are called necessary inferences. That is, something's not expressly said, but by the evidence that's there, you draw a certain conclusion. I think it's a necessary inference that this was a miracle. This was the act of God happening, and not merely an earthquake. You say, well, what would make you think that? You ever seen an earthquake unlock people's shackles? Now, that would be a first. God intervenes into this. And what a relief that must have been for Paul and Silas. To know that they weren't abandoned, they weren't alone. As we were singing about Jesus a little while ago on Olive's brow, being basically alone, even going forth from Peter and James and John by himself to pray. Loneliness complicates the challenges of life, and they were not alone. God indicates His presence by an earthquake, and the shackles of the prisoners were unlocked. And then, lo and behold, what happens? The jailer himself is converted to the Lord. First, being physically saved, he was about to commit suicide. He assumed that the prisoners would all be gone. You know, this is the first of two times this happens in Paul's life. Remember in the shipwreck later in Acts? And the command was about to go out to kill all the prisoners because they were afraid they would escape in the shipwreck. And Paul's influence holds sway there. Apparently Paul's influence and Silas's hold sway here. The prisoners have not escaped. Their shackles have fallen off. They didn't go anywhere. The jailer, assuming that they had, was ready to commit suicide. And Paul says, don't do yourself any harm. And then this leads to teaching the man. He becomes a Christian. And then at the end of the chapter, we find public vindication and the release from the prison. The magistrates the next day understood they had made a grievous mistake. This being a Roman colony and feeling this closeness with Rome perhaps is what led to Paul and Silas being beaten and imprisoned without a trial, but it also worked in reverse because later they found out Paul was a Roman citizen. And in having Paul beaten and imprisoned, they had violated Roman law of the highest order. And they themselves could have suffered the loss of their life if this gets back to Rome, that they had so treated a Roman citizen in this way. So the magistrates were going to let them out quietly, and Paul says, not on your life. They did this to us publicly. They can come publicly themselves and let us out. And I don't necessarily take that to be a demand for personal vindication, perhaps as much as Paul wanting the gospel to be vindicated. I want a public acknowledgement that we were wrongly beaten and imprisoned. That there is nothing about the doctrine that we teach that deserve this kind of treatment. And so, at the end of the day, we see that Paul and Silas are vindicated. The gospel itself is vindicated. And they are let out of prison. And then from Philippi, they then go on to preach the gospel in other places. Some thoughts on what happens here historically, and then we'll close the lesson. Number one, the gospel can thrive in hostile conditions. In fact, it seems that as you begin to chronicle the unfolding of the kingdom, it's almost as if God is deliberately trying to prove this point. That there are times where the opposition of the gospel is fierce, either by the Jews, which certainly happens early on and will continue to happen even in Paul's journey here. But by Jewish opposition or by the heathens that don't understand either the God that is being preached or the moral foundation of what is being advanced, there's tremendous opposition to the gospel in so many places that it goes. And yet here's an example, a prime example of seeing where the gospel can thrive even in great difficulty. We've mentioned in previous lessons, 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 7, Paul says, "We have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. It is not in how well we put it. It is not in how suavely and smoothly we speak. It is not by projecting in all ways necessarily a positive image to the community that makes the gospel grow. What makes the gospel grow is the content. It's the message itself. And in fact, sometimes that message is seen by unsaved people in spite of our mistakes and weaknesses in trying to present it. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, Paul reflects on what happened to him on this occasion in Philippi when he writes to the Thessalonians. He says, "For you yourselves know, to the Thessalonians, that our coming to you is not in vain, but even after we had suffered before and were spitefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we were bold in our God to speak to you the gospel of God in much conflict." Those in Thessalonica were aware of what had happened in Philippi to Paul and to Silas, and they obeyed the gospel. They did not let that become an impediment to them. In fact, by nearly every carnal measure in the first century, the gospel seems disadvantaged. And yet it continues to work victory after victory, convert person after person, because of the content of the truth. That is, it drew good and honest hearts out of the ruins of Judaism, a dead religion still being practiced among men, the immorality of paganism, the false philosophies of idolatry. Good and honest hearts were being drawn from those backgrounds because of the content, the substance of the gospel itself. And we might also note the gospel did not convert all the women at the riverside, apparently. Only Lydia is mentioned here in Acts 16. The gospel did not convert all of the city officials. The jailer is the one that is mentioned being converted. Nothing is said about the other prisoners being converted, though apparently they were impressed to some degree by what they were hearing. I think this says something about the quality of the people that are drawn by the gospel. People can have an interest in the gospel of all different shades and meanings and strengths of interest, but it will ultimately draw the people who want more than anything else to be in a relationship with God. To have their sins forgiven, to have the guilt of that sin removed, the anxiety of dying removed from their lives, the sense of purposelessness that has no direction for them in life, people that genuinely want those things remedied in their life, they will hear the gospel. And they will hear it in spite of my halting attempt to teach, in spite of the lack of knowledge that I would possess in trying to get across to them, all of the things that society says needs to be in place from a marketing standpoint to draw people to a local church. I'm telling you, none of that was present in Philippi. None of it. But the gospel drew good and honest people like the jailer and Lydia and others who became the foundation of a great, strong church in Philippi, one that had great love and appreciation for Paul, which is brought out in his later epistle to the Philippians. The second point to notice, I think, from this story is this. The life of a Christian is filled with emotional ups and downs, but joy can be constant. Because the joy isn't emotionally based. Paul was up, Paul was down. I'm sure Paul was frustrated. Sometimes he wondered which way to go, and it doesn't seem like this is going to work. Then arrested and falsely accused and beaten and put in stocks in the prison and doing what again? Singing and praying. The joy that a Christian feels is not based on circumstance. It's not based on how stable perhaps everything is going in my life at the present time. It's based on a deeper understanding of a relationship with God and what is offered to me in that relationship. How it enriches my life and strengthens me in so many ways that go beyond the immediate circumstance in which I happen to find myself. We counterbalance the occasional ups and downs in our circumstances. We counterbalance that with a faith and a confidence in God that goes much more deeply than the moment. And so Christians should have a deeper insight into spiritual realities and spiritual truths that give relief and strength during times of great uncertainty. In the book of Philippians that Paul writes to these very brethren later, Philippians chapter 1, beginning in verse 25, "And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy of faith." It's an interesting phrase, for your joy of faith. And he's writing this to them again from being in prison at a later occasion. "That your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again." Verse 27 of chapter 1 of Philippians. "Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, and not in any way terrified by your adversaries, which is to them a proof of perdition, but to you of salvation, and that from God. For to you it has been granted on behalf of Christ not only to believe in Him, but also to suffer for His sake, having the same conflict which you saw in me and now here is in me." You know what Paul's saying to these people? You remember what happened to me when I was with you? You've been called to the same thing. You see where I am now? I'm in prison. You're being called to the same thing. But how interesting that in verse 25, before he talks about that, he mentions the joy of faith. The joy of faith. In fact, you know, it may be that being a Christian increases distress of spirit because we see things the world doesn't see. We evaluate things the way the world doesn't evaluate them. We know the deeper truths about sin and failure in eternity and judgment. And those things can cause us distress if we lose sight of the fact that we live under the providence of God. And finally, in keeping with the theme for the year, Lydia, when baptized, immediately becomes a servant. "If you've judged me to be faithful, come into my home." You see how the spirit of service immediately takes root in this good and honest heart that is drawn by the gospel. By a gospel preached in very hostile and unfriendly circumstances. By an apostle who had ultimate confidence in the providence of God. That though his life was, we might see by the chart, a roller coaster, up and down and up and down and up and down, there was a constancy on his part of joy deep and abiding sense of well-being that all will be well, though perhaps at times he'd scratch his head and say, for the life of me, I can't figure out how this is going to work. But it did, didn't it? Even going back and reading these stories in the book of Acts, we might scratch our head and say, how in the world did the gospel take root in Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, Corinth? Brethren, it's the content of the gospel. That's what draws good and honest hearts. That's what establishes them in the faith. That's what helps them make the decision to commit themselves to Christ and sacrifice or face whatever may come in that. Because the content of the gospel, the love of God, the grace of God, the mercy, yes, the fear of judgment, the responsibility to use our lives properly before God while here, all of those things and many others will draw a good person from the world and convince them that they need to be committed to the Lord. And there may be somebody here like that this morning. Maybe you've evaluated your life and examined yourself closely and you've come up empty. Whatever I'm doing is not working. I haven't found meaning and I haven't found purpose and I haven't found happiness in the way that I've been living. And I begin now to see these truths about being a child of God and who Jesus is and what He's done for me. And if there's somebody here this morning that desires to take advantage of this opportunity to commit yourself to the Lord, we would love nothing more than to serve you and help you in doing that, bringing your life into harmony and into a relationship with God before we leave and go our ways this afternoon. We're going to be standing and singing a song, and if we can help you in any way in your relationship with God, would you come even now while we're standing and singing?